Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young.
Call them tamale pancakes, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone.
On today's show, Alex Chambers brings us a story about the national dish of El Salvador, pupusas. Alex spent time in the kitchen with poet Willie Palomo, making pupusas, sharing food memories, and poetry. And from Harvest Public Media, a story on conservation programs in the Farm Bill and what they might mean for farmers. Stay tuned for all that, just ahead on Earth Eats.
All right, Kate, so we're switching places today.
That's right. I've got the news.
You've got the news today.
Okay, thanks, Alex.
You're welcome.
The quantity of corn and soybeans grown in the Midwest and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions have both radically changed over the past century. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer says a new report compares how these two factors have impacted climate change.
Summers in the Corn Belt have had more rainfall and higher humidity, but a small decrease in temperature. Researchers at MIT looked at whether greenhouse gas emissions or more intensive farming played the bigger role in these climate changes. Ross Alter is the lead author of the study.
We provided very strong evidence that agricultural intensification is a stronger forcing of these observed changes than greenhouse gas emissions were.
More plants taking up water ultimately means more moisture in the air, increasing rain and moderating temperatures. Iowa State University agronomist Rick Cruz says irrigation specifically, not just crop expansion, may be the real culprit. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The whole grain food company Kashi plans to quadruple the amount of grain it will source from fields that are switching over from conventional to organic. The company says it will buy certified transitional ingredients from over 4,000 acres and has paid participating farmers $1 million since it started the program in 2016. Kashi also launched a new cinnamon French toast cereal that will bear the transitional label. Farmers who want to make the move from conventional to organic face a big financial barrier as they switch to more expensive production during a 3-year waiting period, all before they can sell crops at premium organic prices. Though the demand for organic food continues to increase by double digits in the U.S., less than 1% of the country's farmland is certified organic. That means organic food manufacturers like Kashi have to buy raw ingredients overseas from countries like Romania and Turkey, where organic production is abundant. The Organic Trade Association and the USDA launched a program in 2016 to help ease burdens and to provide what they call an on-ramp for farmers who want to go organic. But the project stalled last year after the Western Organic Dairy Producers Alliance threatened to sue the USDA unless the agency scuttled the program. In a letter, the industry group said it opposed the use of organic in any labels that did not comply with fully organic standards, saying consumers would be confused and it would create a loophole for some farms to perpetually remain in transition. Quote, "It's an injustice to those of us who meet and maintain the current standard," the letter reads. The USDA replied to the letter in March last year, defending the program but pledging to review requirements before accepting applications. Kashi's program is separate and already approved by the USDA. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media for those reports.
Thanks, Kate. Nice job with the news today.
Thanks, Alex. I had fun.
You should do it more often.
Oh, what? You're trying to get out of the news now?
I do kind of like doing the news.
A fraction of money in the Farm Bill that Congress will take up later this year is aimed at protecting natural resources like soil and water. As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, changes to those conservation programs impact more than just the environment, including farmers' bottom lines.
The slew of federal conservation programs gives farmers another financial reason to keep land, water, air, and animals healthy. But most importantly, says Larry Clemens of the environmental group The Nature Conservancy, the Farm Bill protects private land and mitigates issues like nutrient runoff that's harmful to drinking water and aquatic life.
It provides ranchers, farmers, and forest landowners with the tools necessary to protect and conserve not only the land, but also their way of life.
There are three main and popular programs, to the point that some farmers have been waiting for years to join. But there's also a debate about whether the programs pay farmers for doing nothing with the land. We'll get back to that. First, let's break down the biggest programs that get the lion's share of conservation funding. The first two are pretty similar. One is called the Conservation Stewardship Program and covers up to 10 million acres, about the size of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. The second is called EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. Both pay farmers to use methods like planting cover crops. Ryan Britt, a fifth-generation farmer in Clifton, Missouri, received EQIP money to install a more environmentally friendly grazing system for his cattle. He says doing so improves his soil health and helps his bottom line.
Not only is it important to me as an average producer that I am profitable, and to be profitable, I have to make sure that I'm efficient, that I'm not wasting anything.
Britt says he'd like more money so he can terrace his land to prevent erosion, but is running up against the program's popularity. In 2016, EQIP was paying for more than 36,000 different projects.
I've had an application for cost share terraces federally for 3 years that has not been granted yet.
What is it? What's the holdup?
Just competitiveness.
Britt also owns a plot of land in the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. That's our third program and the largest one. The federal government pays farmers like Britt to take highly erodible land out of production, effectively retiring that land, usually for 10 to 15 years. But Britt says he's concerned that CRP land is being taken advantage of.
Certain counties within Missouri has a high enough cash rent rate that it's actually competing with young producers trying to expand or trying to be able to provide for their family.
Basically, he's saying some farmers can make more money enrolling their land in the CRP program rather than leasing it to others. CRP land is capped at 24 million acres, the size of Indiana, and it's nearly full.
In fact, the situation now where we're very close to the cap is actually somewhat unusual in the history of the program.
Pat Westhoff is the director of the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri. He says while some farmers would like to see land taken out of CRP and returned to production, others think adding acres would help those who have been dealing with a glut of grain and low crop prices.
Frankly, it's a supply control measure. If there's less land being used for crop production, that will give at least a modest bump to commodity prices and therefore protect the income of other farmers.
Farmers have been asking lawmakers to, if nothing else, keep conservation program funding as it stands. But beyond the financial aspect, conservation practices impact the health of the U.S. ecosystem. Take the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Chemicals and waste from farms in the Midwest flowed south, turning a big part of the Gulf into a place nothing will grow. Environmentalists and many farmers hope more conservation practices upstream can better protect all living things downstream. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Find more news from the Heartland at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And now we go to a story from Earth Eats associate producer, Alex Chambers.
Hey, Kate. So, a few weeks ago, I met a poet.
My name's Willie Palomo.
Who taught me to make pupusas. Pupusas are El Salvador's national dish. The country even got the Central American Free Trade Agreement to give them the corner on the pupusa export market. So they have a lot to do with identity for El Salvador, and for Willie, too, whose identity is complicated.
I grew up Mormon and Salvadoran, liking hip-hop in a suburb of Utah, so that's like a weird place to be.
And maybe contributed to the teenage identity crisis that led him to poetry. But we'll get to that. First, pupusas. How to describe them? You might call them a sort of a corn griddle cake.
Call them tamale pancake, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone. The Spanish couldn't pronounce...
You could also just say they're tortillas filled with cheese and pork and beans.
So it's like a stealth tortilla?
Yeah, a stealth tortilla.
And traditionally, you eat the pupusas with cortillo on top. And cortillo is this topping that's made out of chopped cabbage, carrots. Some people throw other vegetables like beets or something in there. And then you also grind up tomatoes and then throw some seasoning in that, and then you end up with salsa. So you usually put those toppings on the pupusas, and traditionally you eat it with your hands.
The cortito needs time to pickle, so we decided to start with that.
What traditionally you do is like grab a whole head of cabbage, grab some carrots, and you'd slice them up. And some people put beets along with it. But what I did was just buy coleslaw from the grocery store, like raw. And then I'm just going to throw it into a bowl right now.
Onions? Are there onions in there?
Yeah.
So, cabbage, carrots, onions, maybe some beets. Slice them all into a bowl. Throw in some oregano and black pepper. Fill it about halfway with apple cider vinegar and top the rest up with water.
Traditionally, the way you make this, you actually let it soak into vinegar and water for a day.
But in our case, it would just be the couple of hours it would take to make the pupusas themselves. While the cortito sat, we got going on the pupusa filling.
So I got some pork loin chop cut thin from Kroger. And what we're going to do with it is cut it in smaller pieces right now. And then we're going to season it with some adobo. And like adobo is just like Latin mama's secret.
Which is, to give the secret away, sorry Willie, a dry seasoning mix that you can also get at Kroger.
And what we're going to do is fry the pork up until it's a little bit goldenish. And then we're going to mix it with some tomatoes and with some onions in a food processor. So looking at the pork right now, this looks like it's about done. So now that the pork is all done, I'm going to move to the food processor and put all the pork in there. We're going to grind it up with some tomatoes and onions. So let's see. We're going to chop up two onions.
Three tomatoes, then throw in some adobo.
Yeah, and you essentially want to grind it up into it's a bit pasty. The reason being is this is what's going to end up going inside the pupusas.
With the pork all done, we made masa, that dough made of masa harina and water you use to make tortillas. Willie filled his mixing bowl about halfway with masa harina and then poured in some water and started to mix it up with his hands.
It's really about getting the right sort of feel.
Kind of like, is like Play-Doh? Is that kind of what you're going for?
Yeah, Play-Doh is what you're going for.
So, we had our masa Play-Doh, which smelled like fresh tortillas, and our blend of pork and tomatoes and onions. Now we needed something rich to pull it all together.
I bought two queso frescos, and then I'm going to mix probably like two bags of mozzarella cheese with it. The reason mozzarella cheese works well is because what's delicious about pupusas is that the cheesy ones, like you're biting into it and like the cheese stretches as you're eating them. So that's always a delightful part of it.
And at last, the fillings were ground up and ready. The cortito was pickling and the masa was waiting. It was finally time to make pupusas.
Yeah, so now we're at the point where we can actually start preparing it. What I have right now is the masa. So you want to grab the masa and you want to make a small kind of ball of it in your hand. So you roll them out between your hands.
And how would you? How big would you describe that ball?
It kind of depends on how big your hands are, I guess. But like mine is, how big would this be? That's like a little bit bigger than a golf ball, right?
Yeah, I'd say.
Like I don't play golf. It would be like if it's the size of an apple, it's too big.
Okay.
This is like a kiwi size. And then you, so once you get the ball, you flatten it between your hands by just smacking your hands together. And then once you get a flattened kind of tortilla, like roundish tortilla like shape in your hand, you grab a small fingerful of the pork and you put it in. And then you grab about the same amount of cheese and you put it into the center of the pupusa, so like the tortilla-ish part. And then once you have it all in there, kind of like it's a flour, you put the edges of the tortilla up, and this is kind of the hardest part to explain. And then you make sure it's all closed in. So what it looks like right now is like a ball again, because I closed everything up. And then I'm just rolling that between my hands. And then what we're going to do is flatten this ball again. And then what ends up happening is that it ends up looking flat like a tortilla again. So now I'm just placing it onto the pan. That's quite a bit bigger one. Yes, because you want to be able to cook more than one at once, or else it is just like it already takes such a long time. You want to be able to speed up the process a little bit. And then like the way my mom grew up making these was over... leña, which is like kind of an open flame stove where you like stick wood and stuff like that. I was in El Salvador this past summer and hearing some stories just about my grandma and stuff like that, and apparently she would like wake up at 3 a.m, kill a pig or two, have it cut up and all butchered, then make the first bit of it, which was like the fritada, which is like fried pork, and then like sell pieces of those off, and then like send my mom and her sisters to go sell, and then she'd make another thing that you can make out of pork, and then by noon she would be making pupusas. And this was in the context of a story of my grandma being like a badass and like how much work she would get done making all this stuff. So it's kind of an involved process to make the pupusas. I expect to be here for another little bit to end up with a decent batch.
Yeah, it was another little bit. I put down the mic to help Willie out. After a while, the kitchen was hazy with smoke from the griddle, and we had a good stack of pupusas. I figured we were close to done. And then I saw the mountains of ground pork and cheese looming over us on the counter, and I decided to make peace with being there all night. I mean, Willie's a good guy to hang out with, but I was getting hungry. Luckily, around the time the fire alarm went off...
It is kind of normal if your fire alarm goes off.
Willie suggested we take a break and eat. I was relieved. We each took a couple pupusas, piled on the cortito, and dug in. They were really satisfying. Salty from the pork, bright with the cortito's acid, and rich with the queso and mozzarella. As Willie pointed out, they're a good dish for a big gathering. He sometimes makes them with a friend for the free dinners at La Casa, the Latino Cultural Center at Indiana University. Historically, though, the labor of making these didn't usually fall to the guys.
The pupusas are traditionally made by, like, the woman in the culture. There's definitely something weird that, like, I'm a guy who makes pupusas. And, like, when I go back to El Salvador, they're like, you go in the kitchen with your mom and you, like, make pupusas with her? Like, growing up, like, as kids, we, like, my mom would let us play with the masa. And, like, of course we wanted to. It was like Play-Doh. We were like, ah. And my dad used to get mad and then be like, no, like, you guys, like, especially the boys, aren't supposed to be making pupusas.
I wonder what his dad thought about him becoming a poet.
My father used to slap my hands for squeezing maseca like Play-Doh. Making pupusas is a woman's work. Call me a maricón.
As we're talking and I'm trying to understand what it is about writing poems that's connected to pupusas, suddenly, like that moment when the dry powder of the masa harina coheres into a Play-Doh-y paste, it starts to come together. I realize that what got him started making pupusas must be the same as what made him a writer.
That definitely is. Like, I'm the one in my family who's been the most curious and the one who's been, like, the most trying to preserve. And I guess the one who had the biggest identity crisis, honestly, who, like, had the hardest time trying to grapple with, like, who the heck I was. And what that drew me to was, like, exploring my culture more and actually being the one who asked my mom and dad the most questions. What I'm trying to get at right now is that, like, especially with a lot of Salvadoran parents who are in the U.S., of my generation at least, they came here because of they were refugees of a civil war.
The Salvadoran Civil War, which started, officially at least, with a military coup in 1979. Throughout the 1980s, the government terrorized the civilian population with threats, disappearances, and publicized killings of anyone opposing them, including students, journalists, peasants, clergy, medical workers. The death squads ramped up their activity in the early 90s, until peace accords finally ended the war in 1992. Out of a population of just over 5 million, more than a million people were displaced.
There's huge experiences with migration, with warfare that they've had that, like, at least the way my parents approach it, like, they never really talked to us about it as kids. Like, every once in a while, maybe at Christmas, while all the aunties were together, they'd tell stories late into the night. Or there's, like, bits and pieces of it that we would have. But, like, there was a certain point where I was just like, yo, mom, tell me this stuff. And that became crucially important, yes, because there is so much there that wasn't told. When I talked to my mom about it, we had like a few moments like this where I was like, oh, why didn't you tell me this stuff? Initially, the first time I asked her that was when I visited El Salvador for the first time. I was like 18. And then I like land in El Salvador and like have this huge cultural adjusting and trying to figure out what's going on. Loved it the whole time I was there. But there was also a part of me that was hugely frustrated that my parents didn't share that with me earlier. We were going to bed. It was late at night. And then me and my mom were still awake. So, like, yes, out of nowhere, I was like, yo, mom, why didn't you tell me any of this stuff growing up? And, like, she was silent. She didn't say anything. So the next year when we go back to El Salvador, one of my tías is there with us again. So in the room when I initially asked the question was one of my tías, my mom, and me. And, like, my tía's there again, and we're talking. And I was like, yo, mom, remember last year when I asked you, like, why you didn't tell me anything and you didn't even answer me? And then my mom's like, yeah, I just got this knot in my throat, and I couldn't speak. And then my tía's like, Willie, you're so dumb. Of course your mom couldn't communicate an entire country to you. Like, that's ridiculous. And, like, once you're there, it's like, yeah, this would be really hard to communicate to, like, a kid who grew up only in the U.S. Like, when I was younger, I didn't even want to speak Spanish. And it wasn't until I was back in, like, late high school where I was trying to, like, figure that out more. So, like, a lot of that was just impossible to communicate. And especially when it came to the stuff about war, when I started talking to her about it, she was like, yeah, I wasn't going to tell you that stuff when you guys were kids. What, to tell you, like, this traumatizing thing? I'm like, I'm worried to mess with you or something like that. So a lot of it was waiting until we were old enough that my mother was comfortable, like, sharing experiences she had with warfare and stuff like that. And, like, part of that, yes, desire and wanting to, like, know is what kind of also brought me to the pupusas and being like, oh, I want to know how to actually make this.
The Civil War sent Willie's parents and his tías and tíos and lots of other Salvadoran families into what would turn into the Salvadoran diaspora. They settled all over the states, from New Jersey to Salt Lake City. They kept their country alive through music and family gatherings and trying to keep their sons out of the kitchen. El Salvador became more than a country bordered by Guatemala and Honduras. It spread out.
That's what a lot of migration, that's what a lot of being a refugee is being uprooted and moved different places.
But then the sons and daughters moved to Indiana, and they want to know how much adobo to put into their pupusas. There's a recipe for pupusas available on our website. I cobbled it together based on the guesses about measurements Willie was giving me, just like the ones he got from his mother.
And then right now I think I'm throwing in like 2 to 3 teaspoons. And so, like, one thing that's really annoying with a lot of Central American cooking for, like, a lot of the children of the diaspora, so our parents who come from, like, El Salvador or elsewhere, is that, like, our parents don't cook using measuring, like, cups at all. So, like, when we, like, ask them, how do we make this? They never have a straight answer. They're like, oh, you just kind of put this much in. And you're like, how much was that? And they, like, have no idea.
But maybe it doesn't matter if the pupusas are somehow authentically Salvadoran or if they're the pizza pupusas Willie came across in Salt Lake City once. I think it's fine if your proportions of adobo to pork aren't exactly right. Willie doesn't live on the land where his parents or abuelitas did. But some rough estimation of the place is still in his hands and in his mixing bowls and the food processor and in what he makes for his family and his friends.
The thing to keep in mind is that it doesn't need to be perfect, and especially the whole part about getting them just flat enough or just thin enough or, yes, without any holes in it is mostly aesthetic. So even those first batches of pupusas I had, like, tasted good, even though that they were, like, hideous and kind of deformed in all their different ways.
pupusas or lucha. They look like tortillas, and Yankees can't tell the difference entre Mexicano y Guanaco entrees como accents y pimienta. Call them tamale pancakes, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone. The Spanish couldn't pronounce popotlax either. What we called pupusas before we forgot to add the taste of nahua y libertad. Take a knife to my skin if you want to see what we're made of. But real guanacos, we ain't afraid to get our hands dirty. I stink loco with Loroco's reefer. Slap and massage masa until it's ass fat. My father used to slap my hands for squeezing maseca like Play-Doh. Making pupusas is a woman's work. Call me a maricón. Once he threw out an entire batch porque la salsa no era auténtico. Whatever. Now you can find peaks of pupusas y pupusas from SLC. Now I smack fried chicken like God's son into la masa and watch it pop y tremble campero into a baseline of humo y fuego. Call them what you like. As for me, I'll call them domingos where dinner set off fire alarms and the entire house smoked with mantequilla. I'll call them midnights mama stayed up to make enough to pay off debt collectors the way we gave our best to survive and fill our children's bellies, leaving them all licking their lips.
Thanks to Alex Chambers for that story. You can see photos of pupusa making in action, find the recipes so you can make these tonight, which is what I plan to do, and you'll also see a list of the music used in this week's show. That's all on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Needmoreroasters.com. A big thank you to the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Willie Palomo. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats today. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And consider giving us a review on iTunes. It helps other listeners find us. For Earth Eats, I'm Kate Young, signing off. We'll see you next week.